The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello again. After last week's excursion onto the cricket field, today we're returning to our literary heartlands. We'll be in the company of two of our most distinguished writers, Anne Enright and Edward St. Aubyn. We'll be going on to discuss love and economics, with particular reference to Irish literature. And we're joined in that by Books website editor Sarah Crown, who has recently just been to Dublin to interview another Irish writer, Roddy Doyle. The publication of Edward St. Aubyn's latest novel, At Last, is one of the most eagerly anticipated events of this publishing year, not just because he can always be counted on to deliver something special, but because this is also the fifth and final part of his family saga, which began in 1992 with Nevermind. But is saga a term I shall regret? This from the man himself.
Well, I've got used to saga because the Germans started calling the series the Melrose Saga, and I took to it.
We could call it the Melrosiad. That's rather more epic provenance.
Let's go back to saga. The Melrose novels is what I always end up calling them, rather tepidly, perhaps.
Okay, so tell us about the Melrose novels.
The protagonist is called Patrick Melrose, and the Melrose novels start with Patrick as a five-year-old in the trilogy, which is now called Some Hope. And each one of the novels is set on one day in one place, a significant day in his life. When he's five, on that day in the south of France, he's raped by his father, and I suppose that's the central event of Nevermind. Then we catch up with him at 22, when he's gone to New York to collect his father's remains. His father's died in New York. And by then, Patrick has become a heroin addict, and there's a series of misadventures in Manhattan around the collection of his much-hated father's remains. There's some kind of resolution, temporary resolution, to that story of his relationship with his father in the third volume, which is set at a large party, and Patrick has reformed and comes to a certain degree of detachment about his upbringing and its consequences. But with Mother's Milk, I return to the Melrose family and concentrating more on Eleanor Melrose, the mother, who has decided to disinherit Patrick in favour of a shamanic charity that she's become seduced by, run by a man called Seamus Dork. At Last is set at her funeral, and the two streams sort of flow together with a man called Nicholas Pratt, who was one of the characters in the first novel, coming to Eleanor's funeral and bringing back some of the concerns from the trilogy.
It has rather a startling opening, doesn't it? It's not he doesn't just come back, but he actually sort of launches himself into the novel in the very first line.
He says, yes, surprised to see me. That's right.
It's very creepy if you follow the Melrose saga.
It's also true to my experience of writing, because I didn't begin with much of a plan. I knew that I was going to set the novel at Eleanor's funeral, and that was all I knew. So I was surprised to see him, and that's why it begins that way.
Just describe him. Is he is actually, in a way, a replica of the appalling father, isn't he?
He's David Melrose's representative on Earth. He has that contempt for ordinary morality, and he's a sort of virtuoso of bitchiness and worldliness. He brings back the atmosphere of Patrick's childhood, and it's because of him, really, that the various streams of the story can converge and reach some kind of resolution.
So now let's just talk about the sort of most difficult issue, in a way, is how autobiographical these novels are. You've spoken a lot about your own experiences, which do, to quite a large extent, mirror Patrick's.
Broadly speaking, the core family are based in reality, and Patrick and his two parents are portraits, and everyone else is less directly drawn from life than that.
You were raped by your father, like Patrick was.
Indeed.
And did your mother join a New Age sort of movement like Eleanor does?
She was very interested in all forms of charity, like Eleanor. As I said, the family are really portraits of myself and my parents, and the things that they do are, broadly speaking, you know, rooted in reality.
Now, At Last is actually set in the UK during the day of the funeral and wake of Eleanor. But there's an awful lot in it of looking back to France, which is in a way where Patrick's heart is, but also where his son's heart is.
The passages describing the Patrick's relationship with Saint-Nazaire, which is his family house in France, are indeed a description of a house that that my family used to have in France. That house is a kind of character in the novels. It's there in the first novel. It's very strongly there in three parts of the four parts of Mother's Milk are set in that house. And in At Last it returns as something that's been lost. And Patrick is looking much more forensically, if you like, at his relationship with it, and seeing that it was riddled with kind of magical contracts that he made with the landscape, with the animals, and with hiding places and so forth around that property, that did an enormous amount of psychological work for him in his childhood when he was either being neglected or attacked. I'll read you a bit. Patrick pictured the white corpses of the toads he used to see each spring at the bottom of the stone pools. Around their spent bodies, hundreds of soft black tadpoles clung to the grey-green algae on the walls, or wriggled across the open pond, or overflowed into the runnels that carried the water from pool to pool, between the source and the stream in the crease of the valley. Some of the tadpoles slipped limply down the slope, others swam frantically against the current. Robert and Thomas spent hours each Easter holiday removing the little dams that formed overnight, and when the covered part of the channel was blocked and the grass around the lower pond flooded, airlifting the stranded tadpoles in their cupped hands. Patrick could remember doing the same thing as a child, and the sense of giant compassion that he used to feel as he released them back into the safety of the pond through his flooding fingers.
Now, there's a real sense in that passage of time compacting through the generations.
Indeed. I think that's a huge theme in Mother's Milk, and the presence of a baby stimulates the baby in all of us. You know? And Patrick becomes very preoccupied by having an infant who can't yet speak, and a mother who's lost the ability to speak, by what kind of experience people are having without words. And that theme, which is central to Mother's Milk, is, I suppose, in At Last, becomes his own inarticulacy, his own experience of infancy erupting in his adult mind. All of us at some point were infants, all of us were alive and yet unable to speak and unable to master the world in that particular way. And he's experiencing that helplessness and vulnerability very strongly and At Last.
And particularly at the moment at which he sees his mother's body and he talks about being reduced to an animal state.
Yes.
I'm interested in the way you use animals, because in a way you use animals as a counterpoint to all the sort of horrors of civilization, don't you, or over-sophistication or false sophistication.
I think the animals, as mentioned in earlier, talking about the house in France, Saint-Nazaire, the animals were his saviours, at least magically, in his imagination. The gecko ran away with his soul and kept it safe. The animality that you're talking about in the presence of his mother's corpse is to do with a kind of somatic memory. You know, he's in the funeral parlour and for 3 days has had an appalling stomach ache, and it's a stomach ache which takes him back to an incident in his childhood when he was with his mother in Naples. And this idea that because we don't have any conscious memory or words or images from infancy, we only have the language, you know, that's carried by the symptoms in our bodies. And he gets back into the a sense of his own infancy through, really, through symptoms.
Now, Patrick begins this novel, he's just out of the priory. He's been in for addiction, not to drugs, but to alcohol. He's changed. He's moved down a step, shall we say. Talk a bit about this in your life, addiction in your life, because you're... Am I right in saying that you've said that it, in some ways you think it helped you to survive?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it might be surprising from the outside, but from my point of view, it was... When I took heroin, I felt at ease in my body for the first time. I felt that there was some kind of intermediary zone between living and suicide. You know, the sort of lotus-eating postponement of either of the decision to live or to kill myself, which heroin served very well. And the first 3 weeks were perfect. The next 12 years were less and less enjoyable.
Patrick, therefore, in At Last, to some extent, is self-medicating, isn't he?
At Last is about renouncing all the consolations that he's used in the past, drugs and drink, women, whatever, out-of-control extravagance. All of those consolations. And to his surprise, you know, by renouncing all those things, instead of entering into a sort of bleaker, more stoical world, he has the experience that he has in the last chapter, which was completely unplanned and emerged while I was writing it, and which I don't really want to paraphrase.
No, we're not going to give it away for people who have yet to read it.
But it is some kind of resolution, which is...
It's a resolution, but it isn't... One might think that, you know, there is this old saw that all biographies end badly, but actually this doesn't end badly for him, does it, entirely?
No, I think it ends, he's surprised, as indeed I was as I was writing it, by this breakthrough that he has, which is a breakthrough in his state of mind. It's not some cute plot resolution. You know? It's a breakthrough in his state of mind, which is hard won.
Now, two themes I'd like to just draw out. One is guilt. And he has this line about his mother, how could Eleanor not have known? How could his mother not have known what was happening to him in that house in France? Her guilt is explored, but also he's guilty, isn't he? Patrick is guilty. He's not a very good partner. He's probably an absent father.
At last, Patrick is able to see that his mother was a collaborator as well as an antagonist of his father. That she was in some way addicted to the violence of his atmosphere, and that she couldn't have not known what was going on, even if she screened some part of her mind off from it.
Was this a realization that you came to in your own life?
Yes, I think I did come to that realization quite some time ago, but I hadn't introduced it into the Melrose saga.
And one other thing that is connected with this is the issue of inheritance and disinheritance. There's a moment at which Patrick goes over to take power of attorney from Eleanor just as she's lying on her deathbed, and that will bring him into an inheritance. And what I felt was it was a bit ambiguous whether they signed the document in time before the phone call arrived saying she was dead, which presumably would mean it was invalid.
Power of attorney just would have given him the power while she was alive, but incompetent. Because he, on one side, on one of the themes of this book is this Jamesian theme of this rich American family with a 19th century fortune intermarrying with European aristocracy. And there's this old trust created by his great-grandfather that he didn't even know about and that Eleanor didn't have any control over. So it was a pocket of money that she wasn't able to disinherit him of.
So one might expect him to leave his bedsit because at this point he's living in one room.
He might make it out of his bedsit, but it's not a it'll get him a second room, yeah. The psychological impact of inherited wealth, the raging desire to get rid of it, and the raging desire to hang on to it, the demoralizing effects of already having what almost everyone else was sacrificing their precious lives to acquire, the more or less secret superiority and the more or less secret shame of being rich, generating their characteristic disguises, the philanthropy solution, the alcoholic solution, the mask of eccentricity, the search for salvation in perfect taste, the defeated, the idle and the frivolous, and their opponents, the standard bearers, all living in a world that the dense glitter of alternatives made it hard for love and work to penetrate.
That's such a good summation. And it could, in fact, be a summation of your novels. They've got all those things jostling with each other all the time. That's what the great tension in them comes from. Thank you very much
Thank
for coming
you.
In. Edward St. Albans at Last is published by Picador. As you've heard, Edward's series is inspired by his own life as a scion of one of the UK's oldest dynasties, in which the lives of any one generation are frequently overridden by the patterns of inheritance. By that, we normally mean the shackles of wealth and land ownership that stretches over centuries. But Anne Enright has taken a very contemporary short-term boom and bust as the scenario for her latest novel, The Forgotten Waltz, her first since she won the Booker in 2007 with The Gathering. It's set in a Dublin suburb in 2009, shortly after the Celtic Tiger danced its last. Welcome, Anne.
How you doing?
Now, before we start, let's just hear a little bit from the opening chapter.
I met him in my sister's garden in Enniskerry. That is where I saw him first. There was nothing fated about it, though I add in the late summer light and the view. I put him at the bottom of my sister's garden in the afternoon, at the moment the day begins to turn. 5:30, maybe. It is 5:30 on a Wicklow summer Sunday when I see Sean for the first time. There he is, where the end of my sister's garden becomes uncertain. He's about to turn around, but he doesn't know this yet. He is looking at the view, and I am looking at him. The sun is low and lovely. He is standing where the hillside begins its slow run down to the coast, and the light is at his back, and it is just that time of day when all the colours come into their own. It's some years ago now. The house is new and this is my sister's housewarming party, our first party, maybe 6 months after they moved in. The first thing they did was to take down the wooden fence to get their glimpse of the sea. So the back of the house sits like a missing tooth in the row of new homes, exposed to easterly winds and to curious cows, a little stage set for this afternoon of happiness. They have new neighbours in, and old pals, and me, with a few cases of wine and the barbecue they put on their wedding list but ended up buying themselves. It sits on the patio, a green thing with a swivelling bucket of a lid, and my brother-in-law, Shay, I think he even wore the apron, waves wooden tongs over lamb steaks and chicken drumsticks while cracking cans of beer high in the air with his free hand. Fiona keeps expecting me to help because I'm her sister. She passes with an armful of plates and shoots me a dark look. Then she remembers that I'm a guest and offers me some Chardonnay. Yes, I say, yes, I'd love some, thanks. And we chat like grown-ups. The glass she fills me is the size of a swimming pool. It makes me want to cry to think of it. It must have been 2002. There I was, just back from 3 weeks in Australia and mad, just mad into Chardonnay.
That was Gina's first encounter with Sean in 2002, which will henceforward always be known as the Chardonnay era. In the same way as the late 80s boom was the age of Beaujolais Nouveau. Sarah, you're too young to remember the Beaujolais bubble, aren't you?
Yes,
and presumably you're not.
Oh, I remember it well. I'm only sort of crawling out of it, actually, even as we speak.
Anne, as I've said, the main centre of consciousness is actually 2009, not 2002. Tell us why you've decided on that particular timing for it.
Well, I travelled a lot in 2008 after the Booker, and I was kept from the desk until January 2009, and I sat there for the first 3 months of that year. And 1 week in February, it snowed, and on the 6th of February, I decided that this was the day on which the book would be set. So I anchored it just then in that week of snow. I didn't know that we'd have snow the next year or the year after at the time, so my prescience surprised me. But what moved me particularly about that time was it was Lehman's had gone down in 2008, September 2008. Everybody in Ireland knew that we were falling, and they didn't know at what speed we were falling. They had no idea of where the bottom was. So the book is set in that exceptionally melancholic, vertiginous time after the bubble burst and before we heard the sound of the pop. And the snow, it seemed, you know, there was, you know, the country closes down because of snow. Suddenly people were stilled for those few days. And I just thought, now is the moment for the book.
It's an office romance.
It is, among other things, an office romance. It's also a suburban couple's romance. It starts off as some suburban adultery, going through an office phase and a hotel phase, and then everybody shouting and roaring phase.
And Sean is an older man. He's 15 years older than
her. He is. He's an older man. They're both married. Both of their marriages break up for this relationship. So, I mean, they when the book... It happens. They're in between things. They're not yet in a second relationship. I mean, second relationships are all very grown up and nice, but they're not the kind of huge Greek tragedy of marriage breakups and affairs and clandestine things happening. So the book describes the fall into love and then the fall from that kind of love into something else.
Because she takes on a lot more than just Sean, doesn't she, Gina? She takes on his daughter for a start.
Well, she does by accident. I mean, you don't look at a man and think about his daughter. So it's a great surprise to her to find that he comes attached, not with the wife, which has occupied so much of their thinking and talking during the course of the affair, but actually with this other love object with whom she could never compete, you might say.
Yes, one of the interesting things also is how the daughter ties... The daughter has an ailment, and that ailment ties Sean to his first wife.
It was the truth in a more concentrated form, the truth of what it is to have a child and bring up a child. There's a lot of anxiety around Evie, is the name of the daughter, all through the book. And Gina sees this child over the years. I mean, the affair takes a long time to take off. And she sees this child, she knows this child. And by the end of the book, she's somehow realised what or who the child is. So it's a kind of journey of empathy, really. Mm. When you're in love with someone, you always discount, for example, their current partner. You know, I mean, they couldn't love that drab person. They have to love me, glorious in love me. So there's a lot of denial, or there's a lot of story making about falling in love that I really liked. And it matches the story making and the denial and the fantasy of the boom. But I didn't want to over egg that too much, you know, because if it gets too abouty, you know, it's not about
I think
boom
this
and
is
bust.
One of the wonderful things about your writing is that you gesture at something that's so much bigger than actually appears in the foreground. I mean, this is quite a short novel. It's 220 pages odd, isn't it? But there's an awful lot of circumstance focused in very sharply on the relationship.
I'm not a social satirist because I don't judge my characters for what they have or don't have. I'm more interested in how they're interested in what they have, if you know what I mean. So there are a few designer labels thrown in there. But, you know, Gina isn't a greedy kind of girl. I hope the book is somehow morally poised. The first two readers, two pals of mine, one said she's no better than she should be. She's a bit of a strap, that same woman, Gina. And the other said I was with her 1,000%. And that I said result, you know. And people have read it very much by their own light, and they often bring their own morality to it and their own relationship history, fabulous to watch. I love people saying, oh, she wouldn't do that, and oh, you know, that's wrong or that's right.
Now, Sarah, do you think that we're on the brink of a surge of crash novels? We haven't really seen them yet. This is one of the earliest, isn't it?
Yes, it is. We still, I think, certainly in the UK, at the banker's stage. We had Alex Preston wrote a novel, the first novel called This Bleeding City, which was about the circumstances that led up to the crash. And over in the US, we had Adam Hazlett, who wrote Union Atlantic, similarly dealing with the sort of furore that led up to it all. But actually, the only other... It's not a novel, it's a collection of short stories, but the only other piece of literature that I've read so far that's really dealt with the fallout of the crash was also by an Irish author, which was Roddy O'Doyle's short story collection, Bullfighting, which is about middle age. It's about decline, basically, and he ties this to, in several of the stories, the decline of the economy, the crash and the burn.
Why do you think it is, Anne, that the Irish have got there first?
Because we're good.
Good answer.
No, actually, a lot of my books have been set everywhere and Ireland, because, you know, the Irish have made different paths through the world, and I trod some of those paths in my former books. But for the first time, I was interested only in Ireland, only in this moment. Roddy's book is really interesting because of the way he treats masculinity. It's just he sticks really close to what is, which I admire very much about his, you know, he really resists the fantastical elements. Mm. So if you're looking at what is, it's irresistible to write about these last few years.
Yeah, he said, I interviewed him recently for the Guardian Review, and he said very succinctly, it's happening, so why wouldn't you write about it? Which seemed fairly good.
I think in Ireland, Ireland is such a ground for mythologies that we're always in the business of deconstructing those mythologies or surfing them or using them in some way. And so there is a tension constantly in the Irish writer between the mythology and the reality. So that is a very, very fruitful tension.
You mentioned that you don't always write about Irish subjects, but you do see yourself as part of an Irish tradition.
I do. I mean, it would be churlish of me to say that I'm not. I would say that both myself and, for example, Roddy, being urban writers and being sort of post-colonial writers, are not interested in the kind of conversation that's been happening in Irish letters for so long, which is, to put it crudely, say the chilly aristocrat or the noble or savage peasant, you know. And if you move from some of Banville's early work through Trevor to McGahern, you can see that spectrum, you can see that colonial argument still being played out. And it's not an argument that ever seized me emotionally or mentally. So I don't use those tensions.
It's very much a lyric novel, isn't it? Or part of it is, although it is realist.
It's about love. It's about love. And love is a beautiful thing, you know, so...
It's rather grotty in this case, isn't it, in some ways?
Oh, somebody said the affair is very demeaning. But she says it's beautiful.
But do you think it's beautiful?
Do I think it's beautiful?
Yes.
Do I think it's beautiful? I don't know what I think. I know she thinks it's beautiful.
But isn't that always the case, though, that when you're, if you're on the inside, it's beautiful, and if you're on the outside, it's demeaning?
Well, she says, it. You know, everybody in the office knew what was going on, and they must have laughed and thought it was hilarious, and it must have been obvious to everyone, and they thought nobody noticed except them. But so it played out perhaps in the office space slightly as farce. Is it demeaning to be in love, to be sexually in love? Yes, I'm sure it is. Yeah, that's part of the fun.
Now, there is a tradition in, I'm sorry to go on about Irishness, but there is a tradition of writing about sex in conditions of great adversity, isn't there? Or love, even.
The famine.
When in doubt, do adultery.
It's interesting. Perhaps there is a kind of thing about the Catholic Church that people were married forever, so that adultery had a special appeal. I specifically, during the boom, looked at boom time literature in the States. So I was looking at Richard Yates and I was looking at John Updike, and I thought adultery is a fantastic boom time subject because the certainties are falling away in the face of, you know, financial possibility. Who cares if you have a second family? You can afford it.
Sarah, this touches on your writing, doesn't it? You're a mid-century American expert, among
yes,
other
well,
things.
I was thinking about, yeah, when you mentioned Updike, the Out of His Rabbit tetralogy, the third book, Rabbit is Rich, is about adultery, among other things. And it's also it's the book in which he's rich, he's comfortable, and it's expansive, and there's a sense of possibility. And you're exactly right, the kind of, we probably don't want to examine it too closely a lot of the time, but the marriage, for want of a better word, of money and the ability to leave the relationship that you're in is really, really a strong one.
The fabulous why not of it all, you know.
Mm-hmm. And it was, again, coming back to Ireland, it's the ordinary fascinates me. Brilliant line.
That was John McGahern as well, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The fascination of the ordinary. It's very compelling. And everybody lives these ordinary lives, so everybody wants to read about everyone else's ordinary life as well, I think, a lot of the time.
So, Anne, what's next after this?
the next book, and I'm just too superstitious. I've been, people have asked me this question. I say, yes, I have a couple of ideas, but I'm, to quote John McGahern, he said, with a bit of luck, I won't have another idea now before Christmas.
Well, we very much look forward to Christmas then, and we hope it won't be snowing. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Anne Enright's The Forgotten Waltz is published by Jonathan Cape. So, plenty of fresh reading there for the weekend. Thanks to all of you who joined in the discussions arising from last week's cricket and cycling podcast. There's a very lively discussion on the podcast page about CLR James.
Yes, and then we also had an open thread spinning off it, to use another cricketing metaphor, on the best sports books, not just cricketing and cycling. And one of my favourite comments on it was from Oomph, who said, a lot of us girls knew an enormous amount about lacrosse, even though we never came across it, courtesy of Mallory Towers, which I also remember myself.
Yeah. And Bladen points out that possibly the funniest sports-focused literature is around horse racing. Damon Runyon, P.G. Woodhouse.
I'd add Jilly Cooper to that mix.
Do you know what I'm going to say now? This one could run and run. Yeah, and we're hoping it will do, because you can actually continue to add comments. Just go to guardian.co.uk/books. And those of you who only come to us through iTunes, do join in with the conversation. And for new visitors, why not go to the same place and have a look at all our range of books podcasts, even subscribe on a regular basis. Meanwhile, Sarah, what else have we got to look forward to this week? Because we don't only broadcast, do we?
No, we do a few other things as well, including the Guardian Saturday Review, in which we have Tessa Hadley on love in literature. And speaking of Edward St. Aubyn, we'll be doing him proud this weekend with reviews in both The Guardian and The Observer. Also in The Observer, we have John Norton asking whatever happened to the public intellectual, why we don't value them anymore as the French do, and who are the ones that we do still value. And then on the website this week, we have David Lodge's top 10 books on H.G. Wells. And also we have our Literary Clock. This is an ongoing project where we're trying to map a 24-hour day in lines from literature. So please go and add your own contributions to that.
I have to admit that I added one from The Forgotten Wells and it was rather rude. So I did it anonymously, not pseudonymously, but anonymously. Anyway, that's it for this week. Thanks very much for listening. My thanks to Anne Enright, Sarah Crown, Edward St. Aubyn, and our producer, Tim Mabey. I'm Claire Armistead. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.